socialite. They lived on the city's Euclid Avenue, better known as Millionaire's Row. I have no memory at all of ever sitting in my mother's lap, Theodate wrote. My father was so occupied with business affairs that I was 15 years old before he realized he was losing his child. She described her youth as the extreme of what the lives of only children usually are, but credited this solitary time, punctuated by bouts of crushing boredom and depression, as instilling in her a strong sense of independence. From the age of 10 on, she drew plans for houses and sketched their facades, and dreamed of one day building and living in a farmhouse of her own design. To her parents, tuned to the high society mores of the day, Theodate was doubtless a chore. At 19, she changed her birth name, Effie, to Theodate, her grandmother's name, out of respect for the woman's devout belief in the Quaker principle of emphasizing the spiritual over the material. She had little interest in coming out as a debutante, and none in marriage, which she perceived to be a wall that foreclosed any future ambitions she might have. She called it the gold collar. Her parents sent her to a private school in Farmington, Miss Porter's school for young ladies, expecting that once her education was completed, she would return to take her place among Cleveland's upper crust. Theodate liked Farmington so much, however, that she decided to stay. She became a suffragist. At one point, she also joined the Socialist Party, and she loved riling her father with her talk of socialism. On a lengthy journey through Europe in 1888, when she was 21, she grew closer to her father. He was devoted to travel and to collecting art, and was among the first collectors to fully embrace the Impressionists, at a time when their work was widely deemed eccentric, even radical. It was he who suggested she consider architecture as a profession. They spent time together scouring art galleries and artist studios for works to bring back to Cleveland. They bought two paintings by Claude Monet. Theodate sketched elements of structures she found appealing, a pilaster here, a chimney there. She had little interest in Paris, which she described as the greatest blot on the face of the earth. But she adored England, in particular its cozy country homes with sagging roofs, half-timbered walls, and welcoming doorways. She drew sketches of her vision of the ideal farmhouse. Architecture being a field then largely barred to women, Theodate created an architectural education for herself, first through private studies with members of Princeton University's art department. With her father's support, she bought a house in Farmington with 42 acres. Her parents, at her urging, resolved to retire to Farmington and build a house that would showcase Alfred's art collection, which, in addition to the two Monets, included works by Whistler and Degas. Her father suggested she design the house, under the supervision of a practicing architect. She chose the firm of McKim, Mead, and White, which, no doubt because of Alfred's wealth, agreed to the plan. Theodate's subsequent letter to founding partner William Rutherford Mead revealed her to be a woman of strong, if not imperious, character. She wrote, "As it is my plan, I expect to decide in all the details, as well as all more important questions of plan that may arise. In other words, it will be a Pope house instead of a McKim, Mead, and White." The design and construction of the house became for Theodate an architectural apprenticeship. But the project, completed in 1900, exhausted her. That fall, she wrote in her diary, "I have wrung my soul dry over Father's house." By 1910, she was a full-fledged architect, soon to become the first female architect licensed in Connecticut. 3 years later, in August 1913, her father died of a cerebral hemorrhage. It was a shattering blow, and in her grief, she resolved to build a preparatory school for boys in his memory. A school, however, that would be very different from any then in existence. She envisioned a campus structured to mimic a small New England town, with shops, town hall, post office, and a working farm. Her plan was to emphasize the building of character by requiring that students devote a significant portion of their days to community service, helping out on the farm and in the shops, where they would learn such arts as carpentry and printmaking. In this, she was very much in step with the arts and crafts movement, then in full sway, which held that craftsmanship provided both satisfaction and rescue from the perceived dehumanization of the Industrial Revolution. By 1910, the movement had swept America, yielding collectives like fellow passenger Elbert Hubbard's Roycrofters, and a new and simple approach to design, evident in the furniture of Gustav Stickley and in the simple, well-made homes of the so-called craftsman style. It inspired as well the founding of magazines like House Beautiful and Ladies' Home Journal. By Saturday morning, May 1st, 1915, Theodate was again in the grip of a profound weariness. The past winter had been difficult, professionally and emotionally. One incident in particular underscored the challenge of being a woman in a male profession. A publisher, thinking the name Theodate was a man's, asked to include her photograph in a book on leading architects in New York. Upon learning in a phone call that she was female, he withdrew the offer. She also suffered one of her periodic descents into depression, this one sufficiently severe that she needed the assistance of a home nurse. In February 1915, she wrote, "I am having such persistent insomnia that my nights are waking nightmares." She believed, however, in the regenerative power of setting off on a journey. There is nothing like the diversion of travel for one who is mentally fagged. Once aboard the Lusitania, Theodate was led by a steward to her cabin, a stateroom on D deck on the starboard side. She deposited her hand luggage and made sure her cabin bags had arrived. If she hoped to sleep well that night, she was soon to be disappointed. Charles Laureate, the Boston bookseller, now climbed the gangway, accompanied by his sister Blanche and her husband, George Chandler. "I was surprised that access to the steamer was allowed so freely," Laureate wrote. He found it odd that his sister and brother-in-law were allowed to pass aboard without question. Other passengers likewise noted the ease of access for friends and family who came aboard to see them off. Chandler carried Laureate's briefcase and valise. Laureate carried the extension suitcase containing the drawings and Dickens's Carol. Chandler joked that the contents of that one were so valuable, he preferred not to touch it. The three walked to Laureate's room, B5, the cabin closest to the bow on the starboard side of B deck. Though seemingly a prime location, it was an interior stateroom with no portholes. Laureate was accustomed to traveling like this. One of the first things he did was place a matchbox in his room within easy reach, in case the ship's electric dynamo failed. He had crossed the Atlantic 23 times so far, mostly on Cunard ships, but this would be his first voyage on one of the celebrated Greyhounds. Laureate saw that the trunk and suitcase that he had checked at the station in Boston were already in his room. He tested the locks on his various bags, and then he, Blanche, and Chandler went back out on deck, where they remained until all visitors were asked to leave the ship. When Laureate returned to his room, he took the drawings from the extension case and put them in the top tray of his shoebox, which was easier to lock. He put Dickens's Carol in his briefcase. Before boarding, Laureate had read about the German embassy's warning, but had paid little attention. The idea of canceling never entered his mind. He wore his knickerbocker suit, and that new innovation, a stem-winding wristwatch, which he kept set to Boston time always, no matter where he was. It was his way of grounding himself in the world. He told no one about the drawings. Dwight Harris, The New Yorker with the engagement ring and custom lifebelt took his valuables to the purser's office for safekeeping. These included a diamond and pearl pendant, a diamond and emerald ring, a large diamond brooch, $500 in gold, and, of course, the engagement ring. He took a few moments before sailing to write a thank-you note to his grandparents, who had given him a bon voyage present. He used Lusitania stationery. The German warning seemed not to have given him pause. His mood was full of exclamation points. "A thousand thanks for the delicious jelly cake and peppermint paste," he wrote. "I can hardly wait for tea time to come." He noted that the weather had begun to improve. "I am glad it is cleared. My cabin is most comfortable, and I shall proceed to unpack after lunch." He added that his cousin Sally had sent a basket of fruit, and that another family member, Dick, had sent a large supply of grapefruit. "So I am well supplied." His note was among those that made it into the last bag of mail to leave the ship before departure. The envelope was postmarked Hudson Terminal Station. The stewards announced that all visitors had to disembark. Ship reporter Jack Lawrence left without even trying to talk to Captain Turner. The captain, he wrote, was of that brand of deep-sea skipper who believes that a newspaperman's place is at his desk on Park Row or in Fleet Street, and that there ought to be a law to prevent him from prowling around the decks of ships. On every prior encounter, Turner had been cold and unfriendly. He seemed to me to be an austere, aloof sort of a man who knew his business and didn't wish to discuss it with anybody. Lawrence admired Turner, however. He saw him on the ship's main stairway, talking to another officer, and noticed what a splendid figure he made. His uniform was dark blue, double-breasted, with 3-inch lapels and 5 buttons on each breast, only 4 to be actually buttoned, as specified in the Cunard Officer's Manual. The jacket cuffs, the real show, were each edged with 4 rows of gold wire navy lace 1/2 inch wide, according to the manual. Turner's cap, also dark blue, was trimmed in leather and black mohair braid, fronted with the Cunard badge. The Cunard Lion, mocked gently by crew as the Cunard Monkey, surrounded by a wreath of gold stitching. When a British skipper knows how to dress, and he usually does, he is the very last word in what the well-dressed merchant captain should wear, Lawrence wrote. He knows not only what to wear, but how to wear it. He achieves a jauntiness that is incomparable. Turner, that day, was master of one of the great greyhounds of the North Atlantic, and looked the part. Room 40. Blinker's Ruse. In London, Captain Hall saw that his new scheme for mystifying and misleading the enemy was beginning to have an effect. It was a prime example of the kind of gamesmanship at which he excelled. His goal was to convince German military commanders that a British invasion of Schleswig-Holstein on the North Sea was imminent, and thereby caused the Germans to divert forces from the main battlefield in France. Teaming with an officer of Britain's Domestic Counterintelligence Service, MI5, Hall had supplied German espionage channels with detailed but false information, including a report that over 100 warships and transports were being massed in harbors on Britain's west and south coasts, rather than the East Coast ports that were typically used to resupply Britain's continental forces. As a final touch, Hall persuaded the Admiralty to order a halt to all ship traffic between England and Holland starting on April 21st, the kind of order that might precede the launch of an invasion. German military leaders were at first skeptical, but this new announcement proved persuasive. Room 40 listened in on wireless messages sent on April 24th from a German station at Antwerp. "An untried agent reports from England, large transport of troops from south and west coast of England to continent. large numbers of troops at Liverpool, Grimsby, Hull. Then came the orders to Schwieger and commanders of the other 5 U-boats, instructing them to depart and to destroy anything that resembled a troop transport. Room 40 kept close watch on U-20. The boat's frequent use of wireless provided rich detail about its course and speed. At 2 p.m. on Friday, April 30th, the submarine reported its location. 2 hours later, it did so again, and it continued making reports every hour until midnight, and every 2 hours thereafter until 8 o'clock the next morning, Saturday, May 1st. The discovery of the new U-boat foray came against a backdrop of mounting threat. The Admiralty received dozens of messages reporting submarine sightings, most false, but still unsettling. An Irish policeman claimed to have spotted 3 U-boats traveling together up the River Shannon, an unlikely scenario. Off England's east coast, a steamer picked up an unexploded torpedo floating in the sea, with markings that identified it as belonging to U-22, a sister to Schwieger's submarine. Off the southeast tip of Italy, a young Austrian U-boat commander named Georg von Trapp, later to gain eternal renown when played by Christopher Plummer in the film The Sound of Music, fired 2 torpedoes into a large French cruiser, the Léon Gambetta. The ship sank in 9 minutes, killing 684 sailors. "So that's what war looks like," von Trapp wrote in a later memoir. He told his chief officer, "We are like highwaymen, sneaking up on an unsuspecting ship in such a cowardly fashion." Fighting in a trench or aboard a torpedo boat would have been better, he said. "There you hear shooting, hear your comrades fall, you hear the wounded groaning. You become filled with rage and can shoot men in self-defense or fear. At an assault you can even yell. But we... simply cold-blooded to drown a mass of men in an ambush." On Saturday, May 1st, citing the new sortie by U-20 and the other U-boats, the Admiralty postponed the departures of 2 warships that were scheduled to hold gunnery practice in the open sea. At some point that day, through Captain Hall, the Admiralty learned of the German embassy's advertisement published in New York that morning that seemed to warn passengers against traveling on the Lusitania. By day's end, the news was known to every Briton or American who happened to read a newspaper. The ship's date of departure and its expected arrival in Liverpool a week later were now in the foreground of public awareness. But Room 40, and those officials privy to the mystery, knew much more, that the German wireless station at Nordach was broadcasting the Lusitania's schedule, and that the 6 newly dispatched U-boats were now en route. Room 40 also knew that one of those boats was U-20, a prolific killer of ships and men, and that it was making its way toward a patrol zone in waters visited by every Cunard freighter and liner bound for Liverpool, and soon to be traversed by the Lusitania itself. Although this accumulation of facts, a fresh swarm of submarines, a grand liner underway in the face of a public warning, would seem a stimulus for sleepless nights among the top men of the Admiralty, neither the new surge in U-boat activity nor the imminent arrival of U-20 was communicated to Captain Turner. Nor was any effort made to escort the Lusitania or divert it from its course, as the Admiralty had done for the ship the preceding March and for the Transylvania and Ausonia in January. Like everyone else at Cunard, Captain Turner had no idea Room 40 even existed. The Admiralty's focus was elsewhere, on a different ship that it deemed far more valuable. Washington. Lost. In Washington, Edith Galt came increasingly to occupy President Wilson's thoughts and imagination. Throughout April, she was a regular dinner guest at the White House, although for the sake of propriety, she and Wilson always dined with others present. At one point, they discussed a book that Wilson particularly liked, called Round My House, Notes of Rural Life in France in Peace and War, by Philip Gilbert Hamerton. Wilson ordered her a copy from a bookseller, but in the meantime, he sent over a copy from the Library of Congress. "I hope it will give you a little pleasure," he wrote on Wednesday, April 28th. "I covet nothing more than to give you pleasure. You have given me so much." He added, "If it rains this evening, would it be any fun for you to come around and have a little reading? And if it does not rain, are you game for another ride?" By ride, he meant one of the drives that he so liked to take in the White House, Piercero. She declined the invitation gently, having promised to spend the evening with her mother, but thanked him for his personal note and told him how it helped fill my goblet of happiness. Her handwriting made a sharp contrast to Wilson's. Where his leaned forward and proceeded in perfectly horizontal phalanxes on the page, hers leaned backward and veered and bunched in a cross between block printing and cursive, with random curls here and there, as if she wrote all her letters in a carriage rolling over cobblestones. She thanked him for the way he had closed his note, "Your sincere and grateful friend, Woodrow Wilson." It had been particularly welcome on that Wednesday evening, after a day of gloom caused by depression, to which she appeared prone. "Such a pledge of friendship," she wrote, "blots out the shadows that have chased me today, and makes April 28th a red-letter day on my calendar." The newly ordered book arrived at the White House soon afterward, and on Friday, April 30th, Wilson sent it along to Edith's house near DuPont Circle with a brief note. "It's a great privilege to be permitted to share any part of your thought and confidence. It puts me in spirits again and makes me feel as if my private life had been recreated. But better than that, it makes me hope that I may be of some use to you, to lighten the days with wholehearted sympathy and complete understanding. That will be a happiness indeed." He also sent flowers. In seeking to brighten her days, he brightened his own. Here in Edith, in the midst of world chaos, he found a purpose to which he could devote himself that took him, if only temporarily, out of his apprehension about the widening war and the fate of the larger world. She was to him a heaven, haven, sanctuary. More than this, her presence helped him clarify his thoughts about the nation's trials. On their evening rides in the White House Piercero, he spoke to her of the war and his concerns as he probably would have spoken to his late wife Ellen, thereby helping him order his own thoughts. "From the first," Edith wrote, "he knew he could rely on my prudence, and what he said went no further." Edith, meanwhile, had begun to look at her own life through a new lens. Wilson's interest and the dash and charm of the world into which he had brought her had caused her own days to seem emptier and less worthy. Though her own education had been haphazard, she longed for life on a higher plane, for good talk about art, books, and the tectonic upheavals of world events. A friend of hers, Nathaniel Wilson, no relation to the president, once told her that he sensed she might one day influence great events, perhaps the weal or woe of a country. But she had to be open to it, he warned. "In order to fit yourself for this thing that I feel will come to you, you must work, read, study, think." Edith saw her drives with President Wilson as life-giving. She felt an immediate bond. They traded recollections of the old South, the hard days that followed the Civil War. She had never met a man like Wilson, intensely bright, but also warm and solicitous of her feelings. It was all very unexpected. What Edith did not yet appreciate was that Wilson was now a man in love, and as White House usher Irwin Ike Hoover observed, Wilson was no mean man in lovemaking when once the germ has found its resting place. The president's valet, Arthur Brooks, put it succinctly, "He's a goner." As distracted as he was by the charms of Mrs. Galt, Wilson also grew increasingly concerned about the drift of world events. The Western Front had become a reciprocating engine of blood and gore, each side advancing, then retreating across a no-man's land laced with barbed wire, gouged with shell holes, and mounded with dead men. On Saturday, May 1st, the Germans began a series of assaults in the Ypres salient, in what would become known as the Second Battle of Ypres, and once again used poison gas. Neither side had gained any ground since the first battle the previous fall, despite combined casualty counts in the tens of thousands. On this day, however, the German offensive succeeded in pushing the British back almost to the town of Ypres. A Canadian physician caring for the wounded at a nearby aid station in Bouzinga in West Flanders, Belgium, would later write the most famous poem to arise from the war. "In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row." By the end of the month, the British would regain their lost ground and advance another 1,000 yards, at a cost of 16,000 dead and wounded, or 16 men per yard gained. The Germans lost 5,000. One soldier in the Ypres salient, at Messina, Belgium, wrote of the frustration of the trench stalemate. "We are still in our old positions, and keep annoying the English and French. The weather is miserable, and we often spend days on end knee-deep in water, and what is more, under heavy fire. We are greatly looking forward to a brief respite. Let's hope that soon afterwards the whole front will start moving forward. Things can't go on like this forever." The author was a German infantryman of Austrian descent named Adolf Hitler. Elsewhere, a wholly new front was about to open. Hoping to break the impasse in Europe, Churchill orchestrated a massive naval bombardment and amphibious landing against Turkey in the Dardanelles. The idea was to force the strait and break through to the Sea of Marmara, and from there to link arms with the Russian navy in the Black Sea, and through a massive show of naval force off Constantinople, compel Turkey to surrender. An offensive up the Danube River to Austria-Hungary was to follow. It looked easy. The planners even imagined they might be able to complete the drive to the Black Sea with ships alone. An old saying applied, "Man plans, God laughs." The result was disaster. Lost ships, thousands of men dead, and another immobile front, this one on the Gallipoli Peninsula. Meanwhile, in the Caucasus, a Russian advance against Turkish forces steadily gained ground. The Turks blamed their losses on local populations of Armenians, whom they suspected of assisting the Russians, and began a systematic slaughter of Armenian civilians. By May 1st, the Turks had killed over 50,000 Armenian men, women, and children in Van province in eastern Turkey. The head of the Armenian church sent a plea for help directly to Wilson. He demurred. America, secure in its fortress of neutrality, watched the war at a remove and found it all unfathomable. Under Secretary of State Robert Lansing, number two man in the State Department, tried to put this phenomenon into words in a private memorandum. "It is difficult, if not impossible, for us here in the United States to appreciate in all its fullness the great European war," he wrote. "We have come to read, almost with indifference, of vast military operations, of battle lines extending for hundreds of miles, of the thousands of dying men, of the millions suffering all manner of privation, of the widespread waste and destruction. The nation had become inured to it all, he wrote. The slaughter of 1,000 men between the trenches in northern France, or of another 1,000 on a foundering cruiser, has become commonplace. We read the headlines in the newspapers, and let it go at that. The details have lost their interest. But the tendrils of conflict seem to reach more and more insistently toward America's shores. On April 30th, 5 weeks after the sinking of the Falaba and the loss of American passenger Leon Thrasher, first details arrived in Washington about another attack, in which a German aircraft had bombed a U.S. merchant ship, the Cushing, as it traversed the North Sea. 3 bombs fell, but only 1 struck. No one was hurt, and the damage was minor. Just the day before, in another private memorandum, Lansing had written, "A neutral in time of international war must always show forbearance, but never in the course of history have the patience and forbearance of neutrals been put to so severe a test as today." He saw grave meaning in the attack on the Cushing. German naval policy is one of wanton and indiscriminate destruction of vessels, regardless of nationality, he wrote to Secretary Bryan on Saturday, May 1st. But Wilson and Bryan, though troubled by the incident, resolved to treat it with more circumspection, as indicated in a report by the New York Times. It was not thought in official quarters that any serious issue would be raised, because it is accepted that the bombs were not dropped deliberately, but under the impression that a hostile vessel was being attacked. This was a generous appraisal. At the time, the Cushing was flying an American flag, and its owners had painted the ship's name on its hull in 6-foot letters. Another piece of news, more troubling in nature, had not yet reached the Times or the White House. That Saturday, the day of the Lusitania's departure, a German U-boat torpedoed an American oil tanker, the Gulf Light, near the Isles of Scilly off England's Cornish coast, killing 2 men and causing the death by heart attack of its captain. The ship remained afloat, if barely, and was being towed to St. Mary's Island, the largest of the Scillies, 45 miles west of Cornwall. In Washington, the dawn brought only a lovely spring Saturday, with temperatures destined to rise into the 70s and send men to their haberdashers for their first straw lids of the season. The crowns of hats were expected to be shorter this year, the brims broader. Gentlemen, of course, were expected to wear summer gloves made of silk to keep their hands, as one ad put it, cool and clean. The day promised to be one in which Wilson could indulge his dream, his hope of love, and an end to loneliness. Lusitania, underway. The ship was scheduled to depart at 10 a.m., but now came a delay. In wartime, Britain's Admiralty held the power to requisition for military service any ship under British flag. At very much the last minute, the Admiralty commandeered a passenger ship docked at New York, the Cameronia, which provided service to Liverpool and Glasgow. The Cameronia's captain received his orders just as his ship was about to depart. Now, some 40 passengers and their belongings and 5 female crew were to be transferred to the Lusitania. Exactly how these passengers all felt about it, given the morning's news about the German warning, cannot be known, though at least one account holds that the passengers were pleased, for the Lusitania represented the pinnacle of seaborne luxury, and would, they believed, get them to Liverpool much faster than the smaller and slower Cameronia. Aboard the Lusitania, one passenger, Richard Preston Pritchard, took advantage of this delay to unpack one of his 2 cameras and bring it up on deck so that he could take photographs of the city and harbor. This camera was a Kodak number one, which collapsed into a form compact enough to fit into a coat pocket. Pritchard was 29 years old and stood 5 feet 10 inches tall. His mother and brother called him Preston, possibly to avoid the unfortunate rhythm inherent in saying Richard Pritchard. They offered this description of him: dark brown hair, with high forehead, blue eyes, and prominent features, very deep dimple in chin. Indeed, the cleft in Pritchard's chin was a salient landmark. In another man it might have been disfiguring, but for him it was one feature in an indisputably handsome face, otherwise graced by full lips, dark eyebrows, pale skin, and rich dark hair combed up in a wave from his forehead, all anchored by those blue eyes, so striking in a man with dark hair and brows. A most interesting face, one passenger said, with marked features which anyone once seeing could scarcely forget. Pritchard was a medical student at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, where he had enrolled after trying his hand at various jobs, including lumberjack and farmer. He had moved to Canada after the death of his father to earn money to send back to his mother in England. He was traveling in second class, room D90, an interior cabin opposite the Lusitania's barber shop, and shared the room with 3 other men, all strangers to one another. He had an upper berth and carried with him 3 grips, or suitcases. He often wore a tie clip with a gold ring inlaid with tiny red and white lava heads, decorative faces carved from the kind of lava rock often used for cameos and brooches. He had packed 2 suits for the crossing, one dark blue, the other a more casual suit in green. On deck, he encountered another young man, Thomas Sumner, of Atherton, England, who also had a camera. Sumner bore no relation to Cunard's New York manager, Charles Sumner. Both hoped to take photographs of the harbor. The day was cool and gray, rather dull, as Sumner put it, and this caused the two to wonder what exposures to use. They fell to talking about photography. Sumner liked Pritchard immediately. He saw him as such another fellow as myself. Both were traveling solo, and they were destined to encounter each other often during the voyage. Sumner liked Pritchard's ability to take great delight in life, but without intruding on others. He seemed very pleasant and enjoyed himself in a very quiet manner, Sumner wrote. You will understand what I mean. He didn't go about in a rowdy fashion like lots of fellows do having a time. A fellow second-class passenger, Henry Needham, said of Pritchard, he was a great favorite on board. He arranged the whist drives and seemed to do most of the work. A whist drive was a social event during which passengers grouped themselves in pairs and played game after game of whist until one team won. Now Pritchard was on his way back to England for a visit, and according to one of his cabin mates, Arthur Gadsden, he was very excited to be doing so. Counting the time until his arrival, Gadsden said. The transfer of the Cameronia's passengers took 2 hours, although later this delay would prove significant to a degree far greater than its brevity might suggest. For now it was merely maddening. Captain Turner prided himself on his skill at deftly managing the Lusitania's arrivals and departures, which meant casting off precisely on schedule. Turner had no concern about the German warning. Shortly before departure, he was standing on the ship's promenade deck, talking with Alfred Vanderbilt and Charles Frohman, when one of the ship newsmen, apparently not Jack Lawrence, approached and asked Vanderbilt if he thought he'd be as lucky this time as he had been in deciding not to sail on the Titanic. Vanderbilt smiled, but said nothing. Turner put his hand on Vanderbilt's shoulder and said to the reporter, Do you think all these people would be booking passage on board the Lusitania if they thought she could be caught by a German submarine? Why, it's the best joke I've heard in many days, this talk of torpedoing the Lusitania. Both Vanderbilt and Turner laughed. Another delay occurred, but for this one, Captain Turner was at least partly responsible. His niece, the actress Mercedes Desmore, had come aboard for a quick tour and was nearly stranded when the crew, having boarded all the extra Cameronia passengers, removed the gangway. Turner angrily ordered it replaced so that his niece could get off. The process further postponed the ship's departure. One passenger, set designer Oliver Bernard, took note. Captain Turner, he wrote later, neglected his duty at the wharf in New York at a time when the vessel should have been sailing by having a relative on board. By the time Bernard made this charge, he had come to understand what few others seemed to grasp, which was that on this particular voyage, given the convergence of disparate forces, timing was everything. Even the briefest delay could shape history. The men operating the motion picture camera outside the Cunard terminal moved it to a higher prospect, apparently the building's roof, until the camera was at about the height of the ship's bridge, with its lens aimed downward to capture scenes on the decks below. In the film, passengers crowd the starboard side, many waving white handkerchiefs the size of cloth diapers. One man flourishes an American flag, while nearby, a woman props her baby on a deck rail. A few moments later, a young sailor climbs a stairway to the docking bridge, an elevated, narrow platform spanning the deck near the ship's stern. He raises a white flag on a pole on the port side, then sprints across to raise a duplicate flag on the starboard side, a visual signal that departure is imminent. Soon afterward, just past noon, the Lusitania begins to ease backward. The camera remains stationary, but the slow, smooth motion of the ship produces the illusion that it is the camera that is moving, panning across the ship's full length. A crewman standing atop a lifeboat works on its ropes. A first cabin steward steps smartly out of a doorway and walks directly to a male passenger as if delivering a message. At the top of a stairway, staring directly at the camera, is a man the filmmakers instantly recognize. Elbert Hubbard, in his Stetson, though his cravat is barely visible under the buttoned front of his overcoat. The ship's bridge now passes by at camera level, and there is Turner in frame 289. He stands at the starboard end of the bridge wing. As the ship slides past the camera, the captain, smiling, turns toward the lens and removes his hat once in a brief wave, then leans comfortably against the rail. Once the ship has backed fully into the Hudson, two tugboats gingerly nudge its bow toward the south, downstream, and the ship begins to move under its own power. As the Lusitania at last exits the frame, the wharves of Hoboken become visible in the distance, heavily hazed with smoke and mist. The film ends. While moving downriver, Turner kept his speed slow, as freighters, lighters, tugs, and ferries of all sizes adjusted their own courses to make way. The Hudson here was busy. A 1909 sea chart shows the shore of Manhattan so closely packed with piers as to evoke a piano keyboard. The river was also surprisingly shallow, just deep enough to accept the Lusitania's nearly 36-foot draft. Turner's crew had balanced the vessel so well that at the time of departure, the draft at the bow, as indicated by markings on the hull, was just 4 inches deeper than at the stern. The river was lined on both sides with piers and terminals. On the New Jersey flank, the right side, as the ship moved down the river, lay the vast track-covered wharves of various railroads, among them the Erie, the Pennsylvania, and the New Jersey Central. On the left was a succession of piers, bearing, in order of descent down the Hudson, names that spoke to the ubiquity of sea travel. South Pacific Company, Colonial Line, Albany Line, Clyde Line, Savannah Line, People's Line, Old Dominion Line, Ben Franklin Line, Fall River Line, Providence Line. Here, too, were the many ferries that carried goods and people between New Jersey and the city, with terminals at Desbrosses, Chambers, Barkley, Cortland, and Liberty Streets. The ferry to the Statue of Liberty operated from the southernmost tip of Manhattan. As the Lusitania made its way through the harbor, signs of the war became evident. The ship passed one of Germany's crack liners, the giant Vaterland, tied to a Hoboken wharf. Over 60% larger in gross tonnage than the Lusitania, the Vaterland had once held the Blue Riband, but on the first day of the war the ship had ducked for safety into New York Harbor to avoid being captured and put to use by the British Navy, a very real possibility, as the passengers of the Lusitania soon would discover. The Vaterland and its crew had been effectively interned in New York ever since. At least 17 other German liners were likewise stranded. Below the Battery, where the Hudson and East Rivers met to form New York Bay, the waters grew deeper and more spacious. Here Turner encountered familiar landmarks. To the right, Ellis Island, and next, of course, Miss Liberty on Bedloe's Island. On his left, Governor's Island with its circular fortress prison, Castle Williams, followed by Red Hook in Brooklyn and the breakwater of the Erie Basin. In the distance sprawled the Black Tom Wharves, a vast munitions depot, which before the war's end would be destroyed in an apparent act of sabotage. Ever mindful of traffic, Turner maintained a slow speed, especially in the Narrows, which were always clogged with ocean liners and freighters, and perilous in fog. Bells pealed in the haze as random wakes tipped buoys, evoking the sounds of churches on Sunday morning. Meanwhile, the Lusitania's purser and stewards conducted their usual inspection to detect stowaways. This being wartime, they did so with extra care and soon had three men in custody. The men appeared to speak only German. One carried a camera. The discovery was reported to Staff Captain Anderson. He, in turn, requested the assistance of Pierpoint, the Liverpool detective, and called as well for the ship's interpreter. They learned little, other than that the three men were indeed German. What the stowaways intended to accomplish was unclear, but later speculation held that they hoped to find and photograph evidence that the ship was armed or carried contraband munitions. The three were locked below decks in a makeshift brig pending arrival in Liverpool, at which point they were to be turned over to British authorities. News of the arrests was kept from the passengers. Alta Piper, the daughter of the famous medium, never made it aboard. Neither did she refund her ticket. Unable to ignore the night's voices, but also apparently unable to step forth and just cancel, she chose the path taken by indecisive people throughout history, and spent the morning of departure packing and repacking her bags, over and over, letting the clock run out, until at last she heard the distant horn marking the ship's departure. U-20, toward Fair Isle. At dawn, Saturday, aboard U-20, there was coffee, bread, marmalade, cocoa. The boat's ventilators issued a monotonous buzz. Schwieger, atop the conning tower, noted that the sea was calm. Here and there, rain and fog. A steamship appeared up ahead, but was so obscured by mist and gray that he chose not to attack. Members of the crew took turns smoking on deck, a pastime forbidden within the boat itself. The fog grew dense, so much so that at 7:15 a.m., Schwieger ordered a dive to U-20's customary cruising depth, 72 feet. The depth was great enough to ensure that U-20 would pass underneath vessels of even the deepest draft. This was prudent practice, for U-boats, despite their fearsome reputation, were fragile vessels, complex and primitive at the same time. Men served as ballast. In order to quickly level or dress his boat or speed a dive, Schwieger would order crewmen to run to the bow or the stern. The chaos might at first seem funny, like something from one of the new Keystone Cops films, except for the fact that these maneuvers were executed typically at moments of peril. U-boats were so sensitive to changes in load that the mere launch of a torpedo required men to shift location to compensate for the sudden loss of weight. The boats were prone to accident. They were packed with complicated mechanical systems for steering, diving, ascending, and regulating pressure. Amid all this were wedged torpedoes, grenades, and artillery shells. Along the bottom of the hull lay the boat's array of batteries, filled with sulfuric acid, which upon contact with seawater produced deadly chlorine gas. In this environment, simple errors could and did lead to catastrophe. One boat, U-3, sank on its maiden voyage. When it was about 2 miles from the naval yard, its captain ordered a trial dive. Everything seemed fine until the deck of the U-boat passed below the surface and water began pouring into the boat through a pipe used for ventilation. The boat sank by the stern. The captain ordered all the crew, 29 men, into the bow. He and 2 other men stayed in the conning tower. As the crew squeezed forward, water filled the boat behind them, causing air pressure to build to painful levels. All this occurred in absolute darkness. The batteries began generating chlorine gas, which rose in a greenish mist. Some gas entered the bow compartment, but the boat's air purification system kept it from reaching deadly concentrations. The air supply dwindled. On shore, naval officials did not learn of the crisis for 2 hours, and then dispatched 2 floating cranes and a salvage ship, the Vulcan. The rescuers devised a plan to raise the bow to the surface so that the men within could climb out through the 2 forward torpedo tubes. It took 11 hours for divers to place the necessary cables around the bow. The cranes began lifting the boat. The bow became visible. The cables broke. The boat fell backward into the sea. The divers tried again. This attempt took 14 more hours. By then, the 29 crewmen had been sitting crammed into the bow in nearly airless darkness for more than 27 hours. But this attempt worked. The men emerged through the tubes, tired and gasping for air, but alive. The conning tower containing the captain and the 2 other men remained underwater. 5 more hours passed before the Vulcan at last managed to bring the entire boat to the surface. When the rescuers opened the conning tower hatch, they found its interior to be nearly dry, but the 3 men within were dead. Chlorine gas had seeped upward into the tower through speaking tubes, designed to allow officers to communicate with the control room below. A subsequent investigation found that the indicator governing the ventilation valve through which the water entered the boat had been installed incorrectly. It showed the valve was closed when in fact it was open. This outcome, though, was still better than what befell a training U-boat that sank with all aboard and could not be raised for 4 months. Divers who participated in an early failed attempt at rescue heard tapping from within. When the boat was finally raised, the cause of the disaster was obvious. It had struck a mine. As to what had occurred within, a seaman present when the hatch was forced open found vivid evidence of the kind of death submariners most feared. He wrote, "The scratches on the steel walls, the corpses' torn fingernails, the blood stains on their clothes and on the walls, bore all too dreadful witness. The fog remained dense until about 11 o'clock Saturday morning, when Schwieger gauged visibility to be good enough to allow him to surface and continue under diesel power. It was always important to recharge the batteries in case of a chance encounter with a destroyer or the sudden appearance of a choice target. Soon after surfacing, Schwieger's wireless man attempted to communicate with the Ancona back at U-20's base in Germany. There was no response. The wireless man reported, however, that he had picked up strong enemy wireless activity nearby at 500 meters. Schwieger told him to stop signaling to avoid revealing the boat's presence. U-20 continued north, well off the eastern coast of England, following a course that would take it over the top of Scotland, then south along Scotland's west coast. From there, Schwieger would make his way farther south to Ireland and sail down Ireland's west coast, then turn left to enter the Celtic and Irish seas between Ireland and England, and proceed to his destination, Liverpool Bay. This route was far longer, certainly, than traveling through the English Channel, but also much safer. The boat moved through 4-foot swells, against winds that now came from the northeast. Schwieger's lookouts watched for other ships, but in such gray and dreary conditions it was hard to spot the plumes of smoke exhausted by steamers. Visibility remained poor throughout the day, and in late afternoon again worsened, until Schwieger once more found himself enclosed in fog. By this time, U-20 was crossing the sea lanes off Edinburgh, Scotland, that funneled into the Firth of Forth. On a sunny day, with so many ships coming and going, the possibility of finding a target in these waters would have been high. But now, in the fog, attack was impossible, and the risk of collision great. At 4 o'clock, he ordered the boat to submerge and descend again to cruising depth. That night, the skies cleared, and stars arced from horizon to horizon. U-20 surfaced, and Schwieger set a course toward Fair Isle in the Shetland Islands, astride the imaginary line that divided the North Sea and the North Atlantic. 2 days out, and no longer able to communicate with his superiors, Schwieger was now wholly on his own. Lusitania, Rendezvous. Once outside New York Harbor, the Lusitania accelerated, but Captain Turner did not yet order its cruising speed. He first had a rendezvous to make after the ship exited American territorial waters, and it was pointless to waste the coal necessary to reach top speed when he soon would have to bring the ship to a complete stop. The ship's decks grew markedly cooler, subject now to the winds of the open Atlantic and the breeze generated by the ship's own forward motion. Some passengers still lingered at the rails to watch the coastline recede, but most went inside to settle into their accommodations and unpack their belongings. Older children roamed the decks, making friends and testing out various means of recreation, including, yes, shuffleboard on the top deck. Younger children, at least those in first and second class, met the stewardesses who would tend to them during the voyage and occupy them while their parents dined in their respective dining rooms. Theodate Pope, the architect spiritualist, and her companion Edwin Friend went to the ship's first-class reading and writing room, part of which was reserved for women, but which also served as the ship's library, to which men also had access. It was a large but comfortable place that spanned the width of A deck, the ship's topmost level, and was fitted with writing desks and chairs. Its walls were covered with pale silk in soft gray and cream. Silk curtains in a pinkish hue called rose du Berry hung at its windows. The carpet was a soft rose. Men had exclusive use of a separate, similarly sized chamber farther back on A deck, called the smoking room, paneled in walnut. Theodate found a copy of that morning's Sun, a New York newspaper, and began to read. The paper devoted a good deal of attention to a visit that Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan had made to New York the previous day. He had taken time off from foreign concerns to speak at a rally at Carnegie Hall in support of a campaign by evangelist Billy Sunday to persuade people to renounce alcohol and to sign a pledge of total abstinence. For a previous talk on the subject in Philadelphia,